Blog Talk Radio.
And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. Message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006.
Designed to accelerate executives' learning and career growth at four different stages, the comprehensive leadership programs at Harvard Business School Executive Education deliver knowledge, skills, and perspective that transform your ability to lead. Prepare now to face tomorrow's challenges with confidence. Immerse yourself in a powerful, proven learning experience with full-time HBS faculty and talented peers from around the world. To learn more, visit hbs.me/leadership. That's hbs.me/leadership.
Blog Talk Radio.
And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author.
Designed to accelerate executives' learning and career growth at four different stages, the comprehensive leadership programs at Harvard Business School Executive Education deliver knowledge, skills, and perspective that transform your ability to lead. Prepare now to face tomorrow's challenges with confidence. Immerse yourself in a powerful, proven learning experience with full-time HBS faculty and talented peers from around the world. To learn more, visit hbs.me/leadership. That's hbs.me/leadership.
Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I just realized something. I realized that I've lost some time. I realized that I had my phone on mute, and so that means that I was not recording. So some time has gone by that I cannot capture again. So some people who may have been listening on the internet will wonder what happened. Well, what happened is that I was actually talking to myself. I had my phone on mute, and I said a whole lot, but it's gone into the air now, not to ever be retrieved. So we're going to kind of start back all over again. We're going to do that by playing some music, and then we're going to get into some literature on Cab's Corner this evening. So here we go, Blue Thoughts. That was Blue Thoughts, and that was a beginning to the Cab's Corner show. And we apologize that we were on dead air for almost 10 minutes. So many of you who may have been listening out there in the internet world may wonder if we actually had come on. But we were actually talking with the mic muted, and we apologize for that. Hope you came back to check us out. Maybe you did. But anyway, tonight we're going to be talking about the black artist, the writer, the statesman, the teacher named James Weldon Johnson. And we're going to give you a little bio about James Weldon Johnson. James Weldon Johnson was born in Jacksonville, Florida, on June the 17th, 1871. He was 67 years old when he died, but he had a very full life. He died on June the 26th, 1938. And during his lifetime, he was an author. He was a civil rights activist. He was an educator, college professor, a lawyer, and a diplomat. And he's best known for having been the chief operating officer, the executive secretary of the NAACP, where he started working in 1917. And then in 1920, he became the executive secretary and served in that position until 1930. He established his reputation as a writer. And one of the things that he wrote, which we're going to read some of it to you this evening, is a classic called The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. And he wrote during the Harlem Renaissance, which was a period during the 1920s, which was a cultural, social, an artistic explosion that took place in Harlem, New York, spanning the 1920s. And during that time, it was known as the New Negro Movement, named after the 1925 anthology by Professor Alain Locke. The movement also included the new African-American cultural expressions across the urban areas of the Northeast and Midwest United States affected by the African-American Great Migration, of which Harlem was the largest. The Harlem Renaissance was considered to be a rebirth of African-American arts, and though it was centered in the Harlem neighborhood of the borough of Manhattan in New York City, many black writers from African and Caribbean colonies who lived in Paris were also influenced by the Harlem Renaissance. The Harlem Renaissance is generally considered to have spanned from about 1918 until the mid-1930s. Many of its ideas lived on much longer. The zenith of this flowering of Negro literature, as James Weldon Johnson preferred to call the Harlem Renaissance, took place between 1924 when Opportunity, a journal, Negro Life, a magazine, hosted a party for black writers where many white publishers were in attendance. And the heyday ended around 1929, the year of the stock market crash and the beginning of the Great Depression. But James Weldon Johnson was one of the main writers of the Harlem Renaissance. He wrote poems and novels, including the Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, and also anthologies where he collected and published poems and spirituals about black culture. But he was also a statesman, a diplomat. He was appointed under President Theodore Roosevelt as a U.S. consul in Venezuela and Nicaragua for most of the period from 1906 to 1913. That was before his heyday of publishing and also his time with the NAACP. And in 1934, following his time with the NAACP, he was the first African-American professor to be hired at New York University. And later in his life, he was a professor of creative literature and writing at Fisk University. And he also was very, very important in terms of black culture because he could compose the lyrics of the Black National Anthem, or Negro National Anthem as it was called, Lift Every Voice and Sing. In 1901, he moved to New York City with his brother, J. Rosamond Johnson, to work in musical theater. And they collaborated on such hits as Tell Me, Darky, Dusky Maiden, Tell Me, Dusky Maiden, and Nobody's Looking But the Isle and the Moon, for which Johnson wrote the lyrics and his brother wrote the music. So he also wrote Under the Bamboo Tree for the Broadway show Sally in Our Alley in 1902. And after some successes, the brothers worked on Broadway and collaborated with producer and director Bob Cole, who produced the show that I just mentioned, Sally in Our Alley. And they wrote the song, one of the key songs in the film, Meet Me in St. Louis, which came out in 1945, the song Under the Bamboo Tree. They collaborated on the opera Tuscaloosa, where Rosamond Johnson wrote the music. and it satirized the U.S. annexation of the Pacific Islands. So thanks to his success as a Broadway songwriter, he moved into the upper echelons of African-American society in Manhattan and Brooklyn. So he was very, very prolific, what we would call a Renaissance man. And his poetry was published in major journals such as Century Magazine and then The Independent. So we're going to break from giving you this history right now. And we're going to play for you just a little piece of music and then let you think about what we said. And this is a piece called Hard Time Looking. Share some of the work of James Weldon Johnson with you. And this is actually the beginning of the book, Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, written by James Weldon Johnson and It is a black literature classic. And so in this particular book, he talks about a young man who is the child of a black woman and a white man in the South, but he actually moves with his mother up to the North, where she is able to establish herself, and he eventually goes back down South, and he experiences as a young college student what it is like to be a Negro back in the days when my grandfather was a young man back in the 1920s. So he says in the beginning of Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, I know that in writing the following pages, I am divulging the great secret of my life, the secret which for some years I have guarded far more carefully than any of my earthly possessions. And it is a curious study to me to analyze the motives which prompt me to do it. I feel that I am led by the same impulse which forces the unfound out criminal to take somebody into his confidence, although he knows that the act is likely, even almost certain, to lead to his undoing. I know that I'm playing with fire, and I feel the thrill which accompanies that most fascinating pastime. And back of it all, I think I find a sort of savage and diabolical desire to gather up all the little tragedies of my life and turn them into a practical joke on society. And two, I suffer a vague feeling of unsatisfaction, of regret, of almost remorse, from which I am seeking relief, and of which I shall speak in the last paragraph of this account. I was born in a little town of Georgia a few years after the close of the Civil War. I shall not mention the name of the town because there are people who are still living there who could be connected with this narrative. I have only a faint recollection of the place of my birth down in Georgia. At times I can close my eyes and call up in a dreamlike way things that seem to have happened ages ago in some other world. I can see in this half vision a little house. I am quite sure it was not a large one. I can remember that flowers grew in the front yard, and that around each bed of flowers was a hedge of varicolored glass bottles stuck in the ground, neck down. And I remember that once while playing around in the sand, I became curious to know whether or not the bottles grew as the flowers did, and I proceeded to dig them up to find out. The investigation brought me a terrific spanking, which indelibly fixed the incident in my mind. I can remember, too, that behind the house was a shed under which stood two or three wooden wash tubs. These tubs were the earliest version of my life, for regularly on certain evenings I was plunged into one of them and scrubbed until my skin ached. I can remember to this day the pain caused by the strong, rank soaps getting into my eyes. Back from the house, a vegetable garden ran perhaps 75 or 100 feet, but to my childish fancy, It was an endless territory. I can still recall the thrill of joy, excitement, and wonder it gave me to go on an exploring expedition through it to find the blackberries, both ripe and green, that grew along the edge of the fence. I remember with what pleasure I used to arrive at and stand before a little enclosure in which stood a patient cow chewing her cud, how I would occasionally offer her through the bars a piece of my bread and molasses, and how I would jerk back my hand in half fright if she made any motion to accept my offer. I have a dim recollection of several people who moved in and about this little house, but I have a distinct mental image of only two, one my mother, and the other a tall man with a small dark mustache. I remember that his shoes or boots were always shiny, and that he wore a gold chain and a great gold watch with which he was always letting me play. My admiration was almost equally divided between the watch and the chain and the shoes. He used to come to the house in the evenings, perhaps two or three times a week, and it became my appointed duty whenever he came to bring him a pair of slippers and to put the shiny shoes in a particular corner. He often gave me in return for this service a bright coin, which my mother taught me to promptly drop in a little tin bank. I remember distinctly the last time this tall man came to the little house in Georgia. That evening before I went to bed, he took me up in his arms and squeezed me very tightly. My mother stood behind his chair, wiping tears from her eyes. I remember how I sat upon his knee and watched him laboriously drill a hole through a $10 gold piece and then tie the coin around my neck with a string. I have worn that gold piece around my neck the greater part of my life and still possess it. But more than once I wished that some other way could have been found of attaching it to me besides putting a hole through it. On the day after the coin was put around my neck, my mother and I started on what seemed to me an endless journey. I knelt on the seat and watched through the train window the corn and cotton fields pass swiftly by until I fell asleep. When I fully awoke, we were being driven through the streets of a large city, Savannah, Georgia. I sat up and I blinked at the bright lights. At Savannah, we boarded a steamer, which finally landed us in New York. And from New York, we went to a town in Connecticut, which became the home of my boyhood. My mother and I lived together in a little cottage, which seemed to me to be fitted up almost luxuriously. There were horsehair covered chairs in the parlor and a little square piano. There was a stairway with red carpet on it leading to a half second story. And there were pictures on the walls and a few books in a glass doored case. My mother dressed me very neatly, and I developed that pride which well dressed boys generally have. She was careful about my associates, and I myself was quite particular. As I look back now, I can see that I was a perfect little aristocrat. My mother rarely went to anyone's house, but she did sewing, and there were a great many ladies coming to our cottage. If I was around, they would generally call me and ask me my name and age and tell my mother what a pretty boy I was. Some of them would pat me on the head and kiss me. My mother was kept very busy with her sewing, and sometimes she would have another woman helping her. I think she must have derived a fair income from her work. I know, too, that at least once each month she received a letter. I used to watch for the postman to get the letter and run to her with it. Whether she was busy or not, she would take it and instantly thrust it into her bosom. I never saw her read one of these letters. I knew later that they contained money, and what was to her more than money. As busy as she generally was, she found time, however, to teach me my letters and figures, and how to spell a number of easy words. Always on Sunday evenings, she opened the little square piano and picked out hymns. I can recall now that whenever she played hymns from the book, her tempo was always decidedly largo. Sometimes on other evenings when she was not sewing, she would play simple accompaniments to some old Southern songs which she sang. In these songs, she was freer because she played them by ear. Those evenings on which she opened the little piano were the happiest hours of my childhood. Whenever she started toward the instrument, I used to follow her with all the interest and irrepressible joy that a pampered pet dog shows when a package is opened in which he knows there is a sweet bit for him. I used to stand by her side and often interrupt and annoy her by chiming in with strange harmonies, which I found on either the high keys of the treble or the low keys of the bass. I remember that I had a particular fondness for the black keys. Always on such evenings when the music was over, my mother would sit with me in her arms, often for a very long time. She would hold me close, softly crooning some old melody without words, all the whiles gently stroking her face against my head. Many and many a night I thus fell asleep. I can see her now, her great dark eyes looking into the fire, to where no one knew but her. The memory of that picture has more than once kept me from straying too far from the place of purity and safety in which her arms held me. And now we're going to play some music. The song is Brandy. Thank you.
Now to listen to one of the up-and-coming new leaders for African Americans. This is the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the late great Honorable Elijah Muhammad. This is Minister Ismail Muhammad, a friend of mine, someone that I really admire, following his father's footsteps, Minister Ismail Muhammad.
Article that was published in a book entitled Booker T. Washington, A Re-Examination, which was compiled by Mr. Lee H. Walker and edited by Diane Carroll Bast and S.T. Karnick. The date of publication is June 2008. And the title of the article is Up, You Mighty Nation. The author is student minister of the Nation of Islam under Minister Louis Farrakhan, Ismail Muhammad, the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and the national assistant to the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And I quote, I am grateful for the opportunity to examine the work and contributions of such a great man, not just an American, but a great human being, a great black man who in his blood had both races, black and white. He was able to offer a viable alternative and a solution, not just for America, but also for the problem that his own black community faced in the early 20th century. Our dear theologian, scholar, and freedom fighter, Dr. Hysel B. Taylor, said all of the right things and made the right points. And in truth, all I can say is amen and bear witness to the truth. And perhaps strengthen us to honor the legacy of such a great man by doing as Dr. Hysel B. Taylor proposed, and that is that we have to put aside our labels. We cannot continue to be defined by the labels that have been placed on us that give to each of us a value, but not our true value. I'm neither Baptist nor Presbyterian. I am not Catholic. I am not Jewish. I am not conservative. I am not liberal. I am a human being, a child of God. I am not American. I am not African. You cannot define me by geography or territory. I am a child of God. We are indeed fulfilling what is written in the scriptures. We are a lost people. I'm representing the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. What Booker T. Washington gave, and for which his critics labeled him an accommodationalist, presented something that would have brought black people further along than where we find ourselves today. Elijah Muhammad advocated that principle of self-reliance, of a people doing something for themselves. Booker T. Washington expressed and manifested a spiritual principle that is found in the Quran, where Allah says he will never change the condition of a people until that people change their own condition. As a people, we cannot win the respect of others until we show that respect for ourselves. This is why Booker T. Washington won the respect of the white conservatives in the South, and they were willing to back him up, and did back him up with dollars and money to invest in the building of our own institutions. White folks had already told black folks that they were free, but they did not give us the tools by which we could exercise that freedom. However, we had the right to exercise that self-determination, which earned the respect of whites in the South during the time of Booker T. Washington, and earned the respect of the president during the time that he was invited to the White House. It is this principle, which Dr. Taylor echoed to us, that is sorely missing in our community. That is why Elijah Muhammad worked 44 years to instill in us as a people self-love, self-respect, and for us not to be a Lazarus at the gate of the rich man begging for crumbs that fall from his table. For you don't see the birds lining up in unemployment lines, and you don't see among God's creatures any other creature trying to take the food that is out there for all of the creatures to feed from. The birds are not asking the bees for their honey, and you don't find the lions trying to take what has been given to the birds to eat. How foolish we look, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, as a people begging another people to feed and clothe us, to shelter us. Desegregation has done more harm to us as a people than our effort to integrate and win the hearts of those that oppressed us after they had already given to us our freedom. Self-love and self-respect is the first principle of human nature, and when we show that love and self-respect one to another in the black community, then whites or Chinese or Asians or any other people on this planet will respect black people because we are showing that respect and that love for one another.
We're going to go ahead and we're going to keep that in mind as we continue. And we are going to now shift into another piece of music to lighten up the mood for a minute. So this is actually a piece that is called Looking for Me by Lawrence Beeman.
Looking at you, I said, baby, I've been looking at you. 'Cause every time I try to talk to you, I get no looking next to you. Babe, I realize that. Man, I'm the same old thing you've been wanting. You've been looking for me,
yeah.
Oh, girl, and I'm the same old thing you've been wanting. You've been looking for me.
You gotta admit that, girl.
Every time I see you, yeah. sent chills down my spine.
Chills down my spine.
You're so fine, girl. I said every time I see you, you send chills down my spine. Well, I love to know you. Well,
and you make me feel so good.
Ah, all down the
south.
Washington and the Black Revolution, written by Marshall Washington, Cabinet of Bowie. And we say that it is a message that will save America. And I want to say something about Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington said that African American people cannot compete with white people until we have laid the same economic foundation that they have laid. We cannot imitate them in their play and amusement while they own the industries to which we go with our hats in our hand, seeking opportunities to work or get sports contracts or get our music produced and distributed. Let me make my point with a 21st century example. Imagine this. An African-American singing group and band has a contract to perform a concert on a weekend in Los Angeles. Their pay is $100,000. And they decide that they want to have the opportunity to enjoy the sights in Los Angeles. The concert is on a Saturday night. So this group charters an airplane for $30,000 round trip so that they can arrive on Wednesday morning, giving them time to go shopping. Of course, they are accompanied by their women, and they party for 3 nights, practicing only on Saturday afternoon before the concert. So rather than spend 3 days each way on the road, by chartering a bus for $5,000 round trip, the African American group literally wastes $25,000 of their earnings by taking the more expensive option, because that is what the white successful white entertainers are doing. So rather than use that $25,000 to invest in their own music studio, which will enable them to retain more of their recording royalties, they will throw away that money for fun in Los Angeles. This is because they are emulating white people who can afford to do it. The white entertainers are part of an ethnic community that is in control of the recording business. The white entertainers identify with the music industry owners, and they are not simply hired hands. They have the identity of masters of business, while the African Americans so often have the mental state of spoiled children seeking pleasure before profit and pleasure before business. So we're going to stop right there. We want to end, since we only have a few minutes left, and we want to end with a reflection. Actually, two reflections. One is a prayer which says, "Let me do my work each day as if the darkened hours of despair, and if the darkened hours of despair overcome me, may I not forget the strength that comforted me in the desolation of other times. May I still remember the bright hours that found me walking over the silent hills of my childhood, or dreaming on the margin of the quiet river when a light glowed within me. And I promise my early God to have courage amid the tempests of the changing years. Spare me from bitterness and from the sharp passion of unguarded moments. May I not forget that poverty. May I not forget that poverty and riches are of the same, are of the spirit. Though the world know me not, may my thoughts and actions be such as shall keep me friendly with myself. Lift my eyes from the earth and let me not forget the uses of the stars. Forbid that I should judge others lest I condemn myself. Let me not follow the clamor of the world, but walk calmly in my path. Give me a few friends who will love me for what I am, and keep ever burning before my vagrant steps the kindly light of hope. And though age and infirmity overtake me, and I come not within sight of the castle of my dreams, teach me still to be thankful for life and for time's golden memories that are good and sweet, and may the evening's twilight find me gentle still." And so we're going to close with that note, and we're going to end by playing our closing music.
Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706 399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006.